news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait, there's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
There is only one God, and his name is Death. And there is only one thing we say to Death. Not today.
Samurai is found in death. Meditation on inevitable death should be performed daily. Every day when one's body and mind are at peace, one should meditate upon being ripped apart by arrows, rifles, spears, and swords. Being carried away by surging waves, being thrown into the midst of a great fire, being struck by lightning, being shaken to death by a great earthquake, falling from 1,000-foot cliffs, dying of disease, or committing seppuku at the death of one's master. And every day, without fail, one should consider himself as dead.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 121B, Death and Horror. Now, I've had the opportunity to attend some open casket funerals, and they are unpleasant, to say the least, and this is definitely not a religious tradition among Jews who have a Shiva and have a different process of mourning the dead that I think other cultures should adopt because it's superior. Mm-hmm. In a nutshell, there is a certain prescribed time during which you have to mourn and bury the body. Mm-hmm. And it has to be done as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, as somebody who was born into a Jewish family, was raised Jewish, and I attended Hebrew school until I was 13, and I begged my parents, please get me out of here.
It's like summer camp.
I can't
please
take it
anymore. Take me out of here.
The first couple funerals that I attended were, of course, for my grandparents, and, they were Jewish funerals, and the way it works in Judaism, and for many, see, every culture deals with death differently, right? And from what I understand, the only culture that does sort of any embalming of the corpse and wakes and open caskets and whatnot is your, Anglo-Saxon Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works for us is that when someone passes on, yes, I mean, their body's useless, right? They are no longer, their soul is what, the soul is what makes you human. That soul has now escaped, that soul is now with God, what have you. I'm sort of, I'm an agnostic now, so sort of.
Yeah, me too.
That soul's with God, and the body itself is meant to go into the ground.
And that's it.
And so, we have a funeral ASAP. Somebody dies, the funeral can be as early as that same day, depending upon what arrangements have been made, depending upon what time of day the death is. When my mother passed on, she passed away at the stroke of midnight, and I was at the hospital, and when she took her last breath, and that was a spiritual moment.
Mm-hmm.
That really was. But you make a few quick calls, and one of the first calls you make is to the funeral home, and I believe it was a Thursday, it was a Wednesday, just turning into a Thursday, and they said, well, we can have a funeral today. We can have it on Friday. I said, well, no, that's too soon. Because, you know, we've got to make some calls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Friday night is the beginning of the Sabbath.
So you can't
do
it then.
You can't do it then, nor can you do it on Saturday. So the funeral, I believe, is scheduled for the Sunday. Okay, so, and that's almost considered to be late.
Yes.
And you want to have a funeral within the next day or two. And there is no such thing as an open casket. The funeral is quite, by other standards, I'm going to say austere, but like very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
The casket is a simple box. You know, the more religious you are, I mean, if you're Orthodox, you're going to be buried in a pine box. And that body, it goes into the ground right away, and there is no open casket. You have the funeral, and then after that, you have the period of mourning, which is the Shiva, which is the week where your house is open.
Yeah, and mirrors are covered.
Mirrors are covered.
Which is amazing well. Like, yeah, really. So you don't want to have people who are just Kardashian-ing it up with their selfie nonsense everything. You have, it's a solemn occasion.
Yeah, so I mean, the closest relatives turn their house into the Shiva house, and the doors open 24/7 basically for people to come in and help you mourn, and the windows are covered so you're not thinking of any sort of vanity, nothing but the grieving. Now, mind you, Shivas often devolve into social gatherings, and I have a lot of problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
especially in the evenings when people really come and they're not talking about the deceased. All they're talking about is, hey, so what have you been up to today?
Yeah. Oh, that's the same for any funeral.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing, is that the body is the vehicle for the soul. The vehicle is now gone, put in the ground, and then we will celebrate the soul during the week of Shiva, where we also do prayers and whatnot. So, yeah, the first Catholic funeral I attended was one of my best friend's father's passed away at a very young age of lung cancer. Never smoked a cigarette in his life, but, you know,
ouch.
Lost the genetic lottery.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually go to the funeral. I went to the viewing, and I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. Here I am, sitting in this room, and people are chit-chatting away, And
there's this wax-like figure just strung out there.
Totally wax-like. I mean, it did not look real. It was bizarre. And everyone's chatting. And there is my buddy's dad just lying there, looking very, I guess you would say peaceful, but also kind of strange at the same time.
For sure. My grandfather's funeral here, open casket, traumatized me. And I was just, every time I looked up and saw him lying there, I just couldn't take it. It's not good for kids.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any way for me, when I meet my maker, to be buried within the 24-hour period, that would be great too, because psychologically I don't want to be in the city morgue for a week, or because I've seen so many police procedurals, and I don't want to toe tag and have someone come up and go, oh yeah, you know, Lombardo, let's pull this guy out of the, like some kind of filing cabinet, you know, a subterranean filing cabinet, and then I'm all gray and lying there naked. I do not want that. And speaking of death, I mean, different ways of dying in horror films, I guess, make a greater impression on you than others.
Mm-hmm.
I have a fear of deep water. And drowning is a particular bugbear of mine. I do not want to go that way. And I was saying to someone just recently how if I'm swimming, it has to be by a beach. And if there's a breaker or a cement wall or like a bridge that some people swim off, or like a cement pier or wooden, I can't process that. I can only swim from a beach because I can't take concrete, and I can't take dark water.
Mm.
And some people who are avid swimmers can't take having water beneath them that is too deep, because they can't take the depths. And I am deathly afraid of dark water, even though I'm a fairly decent swimmer, and that would not be the way I would want to go. Yeah, how about yourself?
So, sorry, just one second, because we're talking about horror movies, so what movies would you... you know, Jaws, of course, being one of them, but, you know, there's, of course, you have the shark, Open Water, right?
Open Water really, really, really got to me, mm-hmm. because it was so fatalistic, and it was based on a true story of this unfortunate couple who were, I think it was off the coast of Australia, I want to say, somewhere in the South Pacific, somewhere in that region, Southern Hemisphere, where they went on a scuba diving excursion to, oh yeah, it must have been, because they were exploring the Great Barrier Reefs, and...
Which I've had the pleasure of also exploring.
Yes, well, although, yeah, you did not have the displeasure of undergoing this. Yeah. These people were out in a boat, there was some, I guess, a head count that was done wrong, and... they decided to go return to land mm-hmm. while missing a couple of the scuba divers, who were left stranded and miles, hundreds and hundreds of miles from the shore, and they were left essentially to die out in the middle of the open ocean. And this movie really fucked me up. And this was, I think, a husband and wife first-time director team. They'd come from the world of documentary filmmaking, first feature film, and just have two protagonists bobbing up and down in this black water with nowhere to go. At one point, of course, a ship is in the distance, they can't flag it down, and then knowing that your feet are flapping under you, and there's maybe 200 feet below you of open ocean depth, and what's coming below is sharks nipping at your ankles. So this was... I don't care so much about the sharks, but the drowning mm-hmm. is an unpleasant way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I was very close to drowning when I was a child.
And as was I.
Yeah.
All right. And what were your circumstances?
I didn't want to just... It's ridiculously embarrassing. I don't want to talk about it.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. In the seventh grade, I was out at a house party of classmate. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was in Alliston, Ontario, which is known for not much other than a Honda plant, a couple thousand people. It's 2 hours north of Toronto. There was... Someone had a cottage, a summer house, and it was on a river. And I got in over my head, literally and figuratively, to the point where I was slipping under and my mouth, and I was taking in water, and I was not a good swimmer at that point, even though I'd had lessons, and someone reached out and grabbed my hand and pulled me back there, but I was floundering in a deeper part of this river. And it was, again, maybe only like 20, 25 feet across this river, not a major, like the Amazon hurtling, you know, or the Nile or anything, but... Again, it's like the joke, the statistician who drowned in a river with a mean depth of 2 feet, right? Because it was a mean, and then there's obviously variance around that mean. Statistician joke. I know.
Yeah,
this stuff is really big.
Is that like an RDRR joke in The Simpsons?
Oh, God. This is really bad. No, because it was a depth that had a mean depth of 2 feet. And, you know, the deepest part was, let's say, 10 feet, and the shallowest was like 2 inches. So, whatever. There's a mean, whatever. It's shit. So that was my near-drowning experience. I don't know if it informed me later, but that is a terrifying experience to behold.
Well, here's the thing. When I was younger, I was afraid of everything, and I was afraid of every means of dying, whether it be...
To me, like, even if it's not relatable physically or in the realm of possibility, because mm-hmm. I've never been particularly afraid of getting skewered with some object we would have covered in our book, really, like, it has to occupy the realm of reality.
No, I mean, that's the thing. I was just afraid, and I was afraid to die, right? Mm. I was afraid to be dead. And the reality of the matter is that watching horror movies has, amongst other things, has enabled me to make peace with death. You know what I mean? And, because, you know, the reality is that death rate in human beings is 100%.
Yes.
I mean, they've yet to...
And for all the coroners out there, 100% of deaths are caused by stoppage of the heart.
Mm. So I was always afraid, you know, like, even though I was afraid of going to bed and not waking up, and of course that is probably the most ideal way of dying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dying in your sleep peacefully, but... I think the only... So I'm not afraid to die. What I am afraid of is dying. You know what I mean? Like, I want to die when the time comes. Quick, painless, surrounded by my loved ones, etc. I don't want some horrific, protracted, painful death or what have you. If there's anything, any means that scare me, it's not, you know, being macheted to death by a slash in the woods, you know, a la Jason Voorhees or whatever, being burned alive. That's that scares me.
So I want to say, like, maybe, let's say, cite a film precedent for that. I think, if I'm not mistaken, townsfolk grab this guy and dead and buried, mm-hmm. as an example of that, and then they Joan of Arc the guy in the town square or whatever it was.
There's even like things like in The Burning, you know, when he doesn't die, but he's succumbing to flames and he's, you know, from head to toe. Or, oh God, I remember when I was young, I was about 8 years old, and my father took me to see a movie which I love now, right? Starring one of my most revered human beings on this planet. Well, he's no longer with us, but Vincent Price.
Yeah.
And this was The House of Wax. And it was playing at a Rep Theater here in Toronto in its original 3D. And we walked in just a little bit late. And as we're walking in, it was a scene when the wax museum was on fire, and it wasn't even human beings that were succumbing to the flames. It was wax dummy, wax figures that were melting. And I let out this blood-curdling shriek, and I ran out of the cinema, and my father ran after me, and he had to, you know, get refunds and everything. And it actually took me a long time to watch that movie because of that, you know, that traumatic... there's something about... I guess there was a time when my hands were engulfed in flames. It's a long story. I don't really want to get into it either. But,
you're not divulging in your childhood traumas here.
Exactly. But I suffered second degree burns. They have healed. But there's just something about that, being in that blistering hot flame, and your skin's peeling and blistering, and you're asphyxiating, and you're screaming out for abject pain and agony. Praying for death to come.
Well, it's like those poor souls in 9/11 when the jet fuel caught on fire and these people jumped out of the World Trade Centers to die on impact because they couldn't take the incredible heat from those flames. That really affected a lot of people too. When it comes to, that, because Joan of Arc and these figures, they would have watched themselves burn. So if you're tied to a stake, and then they start at your feet, it's absolutely excruciating. Yeah, on the horror front, a Garrett, or a Garrot, I don't know how you pronounce it, I guess it's maybe both, but a la Godfather or something, where you're just sitting there, and then all of a sudden, someone is asphyxiating you from behind, and there's nothing you can do about it. And I've thought about this, because you always picture what you would do if someone came after you. And you'd like to think, if you're head-on with someone wielding a machete, you are athletic enough to evade them side to side, back to front, whatever. You can run, there's different things, but if you're asphyxiated from behind, what do you do? And there are actual classes that teach you what to do. Like, there's like Russian martial arts and Israeli martial arts, this obscure stuff, but in movies, they always reach for their throat, and they never kick behind them to try and, or punch behind them to try and have them loosen the grip, but they turn blue and they sink to the floor. And what an awful, awful way to go, because of the element of surprise too. Again, because you can't really, I guess, because you're awake and cognizant of the fact that you're going to die, as opposed to someone just sticking a machete into you, a la Jason Voorhees, you're finished.
Well, yeah, but then, I mean,
you're done
life,
for, right?
Okay, but you know, we've talked about this in our book too, about the ease of dispatch in horror movies. You know, somebody gets a prick of a shish kebab in their throat and they knee and they instantly expire. But the reality is, if you're stabbed to death, that could be quite awful. If you're bleeding out, you know, for hours and hours, and you know, how deep the wound is, and you know, a piece of you is sliced off, or you know, your intestine is, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
it's never as clean as it's really depicted in a movie. One thrust of the machete may not be
enough. Yeah, and then you just lie there, or like succumb to some sort of a wound infection, or God knows what.
Exactly. That's why I think, like, it was more frightening to me as something like a war film, like a Saving Private Ryan or something, where somebody, steps on it, takes a mortar.
Oh God! Yeah,
and they're still alive, and they're being dragged, you know, by their comrades.
Yeah,
you know,
missing both legs, and they're just a torso going through. Well, again, a war death. Like, I would not. Oh, I would be just completely paranoid about eyes and going out there and having someone take out my eye with a piece of shrapnel. That is the worst, and that's why the Fulci films really affect me too. Mm-hmm. So I have an eye and a drowning fear. And I was thinking about how the best way to go would be exposure, because you're in, let's say, Siberia, here in northern Canada, because although we can't imagine it now, because we're in the midst of a heat wave and we're dying here. Mm-hmm. But if it's like minus 30 below and you're about to expire, your core temperature drops, but your resources shift to your center to keep the center warm, and your perimeter drops in temperature. You start to hallucinate, and apparently you start to feel warm in your last moments, and then you go. I was watching a movie called Frozen, not to be confused with the Disney awful let song and movie. Oh, let it go. This was a very unique premise where these people were stuck on a chairlift overnight because they paid off the stupid attendant who was so negligent in his job that he said, sure, you guys can go ski down the mountain when no one else is here, and you know, liabilities be damned for the ski hill or whatever. And these people get stuck, trapped on a chairlift, and left to swing to and fro while their hands freeze. So you have also the element of the awful frostbite, which is your extremities just fall off. But then again, I guess you finally get to the point where it's the part that I like, is just going peacefully in the snow. But that's getting very dark, but again, yeah, it's more what
the
you
part
can
that I like.
Okay, well, what was your preferred means of going is in your sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, at an advanced enough age, and I'm interested that you've come to terms with it.
Very much so.
How is that? Because I am the absolute, I am not. Because when you cross a threshold into your 30s, you realize that you are alive as long as you will be alive. And this is something that's really, really jarring to hit. Because when you're 20, you can say, oh, I'm going to live conceivably four times this long. But when you hit your 30s, you could conceivably have lived half your life. Mm. And then after that, it's all like you will live less than you have lived. And that, so I have not come to terms with it at all.
Okay.
And I would, you know, maybe you need to, you know, give me some advice. Maybe not here, but later.
I'll tell you very quickly how I came to terms with it. I mean, as I said before, I was so afraid of being dead. I was afraid of not existing. That was the thing, right?
You were afraid of not waking up.
Just afraid, yeah. Like, you know, the world would be going around me. Everything, my friends and family would be, you know, going about their, and I would just not be, I would not exist. And, I don't know, this one morning I had this epiphany, and I said to myself, hey man, I go, before you were born, the world went on, and you weren't a part of it, you didn't know, you just didn't know,
yeah.
You know, and it's going to be the same after you die, the world's going to continue, you're not going to be a part of it. I wasn't terrified before I was born, so why should I be terrified after I die? So I've come to terms, I'm not afraid of being dead. I'm afraid of, you know, certain methods of dying. I think life is a precious gift. I want to live as long as I possibly can, as long as I have my faculties intact, and I can take care of myself. Yeah, I want to keep on living, but the reality is, when my time comes, it comes. And I think that horror fans are more well-adjusted when it comes to the question of immortality than people that eschew horror. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Why do they stay away from horror? Because they're afraid of questioning these silly questions. They're like, well, you know, I may expire. I may be killed. Granted, it probably will not be by some, you know, hockey mask wearing a sailant in the woods or, you know, being chopped up to be put in a pot pie in some ridiculous cannibal movie. But the reality of the matter is that those of us that love horror, that surround ourselves with horror, that watch these movies all the time, that wear the t-shirts, that read the books, we're constantly confronting death, 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 death. And this goes right back to the, you know, what we were talking about at the beginning of this discussion about different cultures and how they deal with death. I mean, there's a big difference between different religions in Western culture, and then there's a huge difference in the way other cultures globally deal with death. But a lot of these rituals that are performed after someone dies, they're not for the dead. You know what I mean? Like, yes, people, depending upon your religious bent, people say, well, we have to make sure that they make it to the afterlife properly. I mean, I'm thinking back to, you know, even ancient Egypt with the, you know, on the River Styx, and they're giving you the accoutrements you need in order to, putting pennies on your eyes for the fairy man, all these different things. But the reality is that all of these rituals, whether it be the Shiva, whether it be the wake, it's not for the person who's dead. The person who's dead is no longer. Their suffering is over. And whether they're with some, you know, higher power or not, it's not. It's for those that are left behind. It's a ritual so that those that are left behind can feel soothed and not terrified about their own mortality.
True enough, well, but in some cases their suffering is not allayed by being dead. This is an interesting, I almost wanted to make this an addendum to the Nosferatu podcast.
I hope you don't talk about being buried alive. Or...
No, okay. Which is another fear, but there is a form of Anglo-Saxon burial called deviant burial, and there's an excellent documentary on PBS, and in 12th century England, there was a proper way of burying bodies, and it was east to west, and it had to be done in consecrated ground, unless you were some sort of horrible reprobate, in which case they didn't give a shit, and then you'd be outside the parameters of the church. But there was certain circumstances where they found posthumously that villagers had desecrated the body for fear of the deceased returning to wreak vengeance on them. And this is how they figure the vampire legend started. And it's funny in Nosferatu, where I made a few unkind observations, let's say, about, not myself personally, but how Romanian culture is treated in the rest of, let's say, the more self-described civilized parts of Europe. And there was a situation only as recently as 2005 where villagers dug up the body of someone who is ostensibly a vampire and removed their heart and performed a ritual where they took the heart and put it into some sort of soup and did God knows what with it, to mix up a potion or, you know, some sort of, I don't know, ritual to rid the village of its curse. And these people really believed this. And I thought, my God, this is still carrying on to the present day. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, buried alive. Well, these people are obviously not alive. They're deceased, but there were certain things they did. And this goes back to Italy as well. In Venice, 14th century, they would, if they suspected someone was a vampire, they would shove a brick into its mouth. And this was some means of preventing the thing from coming back. They would break its legs. And they found, archaeologists would find these bodies which have broken parts so they can't get up and afflict the living. And I thought, this is a terrific documentary. It's well worth checking out on PBS. Being buried alive, returning to fears. I read a true crime story about a woman who was held hostage and held for ransom and kept underground. She was woken up and they gave her a note to read, the kidnappers. They gave her the things to, so she could get rid of her waste. They gave her water and they said it was long enough for her to last a week until the parents coughed up the funds. Mm-hmm. She had to live underground, and this has been made into TV movies and whatnot, but yes, buried alive, how people are treated after they die.
Film made by the Black Fawn guys?
There is In the House of Flies,
yeah.
Where it is a couple and they're kept in a basement, mm-hmm. and they're being tormented by their captor, who periodically phones them and taunts them and provides them with food and stuff just to get by, but keeps them in a state of permanent low blood sugar and hallucinating, and they're just basically left barely alive. And that also gives me the creeps.
Well, there's also that wonderful, it's not necessarily a horror film, but I think it's terrific, and this is the movie where I thought, well, Ryan Reynolds can actually act, and that movie Buried, have you seen that one?
No.
That is incredible. It's about a soldier. He's not even a soldier, he's a contractor in Afghanistan, and he wakes up underground. And the whole movie takes place with Ryan Reynolds. It's basically a one-person show, and he's somehow got some cell service, and he's talking to the people that buried him there, as well as people are trying to rescue him, and obviously, you know, his oxygen is running out, and he only has limited amounts of what do you call it?
What is it, morphine or something?
No, nothing. Nothing.
Oh, like an IV?
Food? Nothing. No provisions. Just a lighter, because he had to.
Of course,
and
yeah.
And when he would, you know, light the lighter, he would be removing oxygen, and, you know, between...
I don't like hearing about this.
Speaking to his captors, and speaking to people who are supposed to rescue him, wonderful movie, top end and just completely just edge of your seat and an amazing film. And that I've always had respect for Ryan Reynolds upon seeing that film. Funny enough, we mentioned Ryan Reynolds because you were talking earlier about Drowning, and I saw a trailer for a movie with his wife, Blake Lively, who I kind of hate, called, I believe, The Shallows? And it sort of has the same conceit about as Open Water.
Yes.
Lost at Sea, so, yeah.
I was thinking that that is something that scares me as well, but it has a very PG-13 vibe to it, so it's doubtful whether I would take that in, but we'll see.
But, I mean, getting back to death in general, I mean, look, we all have to own up to our own mortality. It's going to happen. It can happen today. When you leave our downtown Toronto headquarters.
Well, I did bike over here, so it's possible I'll be hit by a semi like on the way, and then
yeah,
I'm
it's
finished.
Funny because when we wake up in the morning, we have this sort of unspoken agreement with ourselves that we're going to
make it through the day.
Make it through the day, and we're going to go, you know, hit our pillow that night. And then we hit our pillow that night, we have this unspoken agreement that we're going to wake up in the morning. And that's sort of comforting to us, but that agreement, who's this agreement with? There's no guarantee.
Yeah.
But I don't find that scary. I find that almost freeing, you know? Because it's like every
Well,
there's day.
Some unknown heart condition you may have that will prevent you from waking up?
No, it's just like, I just find it freeing. In the sense, like, you know, like, look at every day as potentially your last and try and make the most of it and be a good person. That's the end of that, you know? And ultimately, this goes back to my thesis from the beginning, that those of us that are into the genre are just more adjusted, you know, because there's no way that we would be exposing ourselves to these scenarios, whether it be cinema, literature, you're extremely fascinated with true crime, much more so than I am.
Which scares me more than the crime that we expose ourselves to in horror films, for sure.
But there's no way we'd be exposing ourselves to these things if we weren't able to accept them. Whereas people that say, I cannot watch a horror movie, it's because they have not, in my opinion, they have not accepted their mortality. It's not that they're scared of a slasher or some contagion or something. It's just they're afraid of their own mortality. That's ultimately what it comes down to. Are you willing to accept the fact that your life is finite or not?
Well, I hope your theory about the therapeutic, if you want to call it that, effects of this genre are going to pan out, because I've continually confronted my hypochondria with my favorite horror genre, which is body horror, and it hasn't helped me one bit, because I am hospital and doctor averse. I don't have a family doctor.
Do I
don't go to a doctor. I'm terrified of needles.
Yeah, yeah.
I would. I'm more afraid of the diagnosis than I am of the cure in many instances, because there's certain things I'm really not afraid of, and you know, like if you know, thank God my eyesight is fantastic, because I don't know how anyone would undergo a laser eye surgery. That freaks me the fuck out. I would never do that. I'd sooner be blind as a bat than go through that procedure. The eyes, in a surgical sense, I would rather lop my arm off or have my arm lopped off, wake up with one arm, than have a laser shot into my eye. I can't take it.
I know someone very close to me that recently underwent an eye transplant surgery to improve her vision.
They can do that?
Yeah. She was given the eyes of a dead person.
Really?
Yes.
This sounds like the realm of science fiction.
Well, there was an ancient horror movie called The Eye, you know, where a blind woman underwent that surgery, and because of, it was so long since I've seen this movie, but it was quite a scary one, a supernatural horror, because of these new eyes, she could see ghosts, and there was some really intriguing set pieces in that one.
Well.
So,
yeah. Well, we'll see.
And it was remade by a god-awful version starring Jessica Alba. Do not go near that one. Track down the original guy from, and then they made sequels on that, but they're not worth seeing, the original.
Well, we'll see if our ghosts continue to haunt listeners here with our future podcasts and our website. We're going to continue to talk about, I guess, issues extraneous or somewhat tangentially related to horror, and you know, return to our recurring segments like Crap of the Week, where we talk about films one of us has seen and the other hasn't, that will be coming in the future, as well as way more genre film talk for you to enjoy. And send us your suggestions, reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, awful_movies, and we'll talk to you soon.
We hope. There's no guarantee.
Nope.
Take care.
Thank you.